Okay, this is September 22nd, 2008. We're continuing our conversation with David Eugene Werster, and this is the beginning of hour 19. And we'll probably do 3 hours tonight, get up to 21. All right, I want to be...
This is a book review, huh?
Yes, yes.
Is there ever one to match it?
No. Unless you consider the way the Jews looked at the Talmud every day for thousands of years, you know, maybe that was
and,
a book review.
And recorded it?
Yeah, they recorded it. They're known as the people of the book.
Uh-huh.
Okay, so considering that the world disappeared in the past 7 days, the headlines are 7 days that shook the world, or that shook Wall Street, and we're the only three people left standing.
All right.
I want to quote, when I called Dave today earlier, he says, "What do you think of this? It's chaos upon chaos upon chaos." That was Dave monitoring the media. So he reminded me that he said something similar on July 24th when we interviewed him for Eben Ray. So I'm going to read the transcript because we could listen to it, but Mon Squaz actually transcribed that whole show. And he said, he has Dave saying, "All right, in the world, as people look today, level after level after level after level is in chaos. I like to look at it as though it's plastic, you know, when they make plastic, they put a catalyst in it, and it makes it all gooey. But after so many seconds or minutes, it rehardens. If it has shifted into a new mold, you have a new place. And as this kind of thing can happen spontaneously, because of the chaos." In other words, there is so much chaos that of those who are looking at it, it can be those in the middle, of, even those in the middle of the chaos, if they look at it with attention, it's like turning everything into a gooey plastic. And everybody together focusing well enough so that the shape of things to come is as a result of we the people, et cetera, et cetera. That's you going, we, for the people, of the people, by the people. That's what you are referring to.
Yeah, well, the beginning of the Declaration.
Right. And then Eben says, "Are you saying, sir, that through focus, attention, that in a sense," and then there's a pause, and she goes, "Okay, could it be then that the chaos in the world that's around us, we've created the chaos in the world because of the chaos that is in us?" And then you say, "Well, the point of what I've just said has to do with attention, right?" Yes, she goes, "Yes, yes." And then you, Dave, say, "I mentioned that." "All right, the point is that if you have a question about inattention, because it was inattention that happened all across the board. Let me give you a simple little example. Did you know what they..." What did they... Transcription's a little off. "Did you know that what they call Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac were at one time government agencies?" And then you go into the effect of privatization. But let's go back to the term chaos. Do you have anything to say or add to that, Dave, in relation to what happened this past week?
You mean me now?
Yeah.
Present time? Okay.
Yes.
Wasn't it pretty accurate?
Yes, you did predict the chaos upon chaos.
Did I leave anything out?
No, I don't think you did.
All right, now, but I have had a view of what they're trying to do today. There's two things I want to tell you. One's a dirty story that I've made up.
Right.
It's where all the suits are stripped naked. They have a rope. They're going to put handcuffs on them, but if they don't put handcuffs on them, if they grab their hand onto the rope, and they're all in a line naked and marching in a Congo line and screwing each other into prison where they become somebody's bitch. That's the first thing. Now, the other thing is what reconciliation of yes and no could occur. If Congress gave them $200 billion approval for what they want, provided they provide the same amount for domestic $200 billion, then at a certain point, if they still want more for their project, that they put a like amount in the domestic side. So if they get another $100 billion, so just walk it up until it's even, Stephen, for what they want and for what we want. Now, the thing of when I say we, I'm saying that the mortgage scandal is going to continue until it's stopped. And the only way to stop it is to match it. So it's like a balance sheet on Libra, so to speak, of this and that, that has been out of balance, and they had the way to do it, but they wouldn't, and they were forced, and it's very interesting that all these things were expected to have to happen on Obama's watch.
Yes.
But in talking to Paul Seibel, we were talking about forces in movement. I wanted him to write a book about it a long time ago, and he told me lately, he says, I can't because it's happening so fast, I can't keep track of it to even get it down. And this is the proof of it right there, that the forces in movement are happening faster than they can control either.
Right. And the joke, though, let's go back to the joke. You're saying that they're lining up, screwing
well,
each other?
Well, no, it's like they're being stripped naked. They're being stripped naked, and they're being put in a line where they're holding on. They're not actually got cuffs on yet, but they got their hand on this rope. They all got to keep it on there, or else they put cuffs on them.
Ah.
So they're walking together, and, of course, the rest of the image I already gave you, which you just accelerated, and was really a ball to look at.
Yeah. Their penises are inserted in each other.
Yes, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Why do they wait to get more penises inserted in jail? Is that how you...
Well, in other words, they find out about this, and they become that when they're in jail anyway.
Yeah.
That way. But
that's if they,
this is
that's
like,
if they don't do the matching funds. That's their fate.
No, I think it's whether no matter what they do, you know, no matter what they do, they're going to get screwed into some kind of punishment.
Okay.
I just gave a visualization that kind of is the reality in a concept and in an analogy. You know,
is those four is it Bernanke, Paulson, Bush, and Cox, who are the four guys attached to the rope? Or
No. They're the ones that are making the others do it.
Oh, okay.
Supposedly.
Yeah. They're making the others...
All the corrupt financiers. You see, the whole point was that they were doing things that were not regulated and were hidden and were not transparent, and nobody knew what they were, and there's no other way to find out what they were unless this could happen. So for all of the conservatives who would have liked to have known about it anyway, this is the only way they're ever going to find out, because they don't even know what they're dealing with.
Yeah.
And it goes all over the world to almost every bank in the world, because this stuff has been sold down and down and down and down. So when they supposedly bailed out AIG, that was to stop the actions all across the world from happening.
Yeah.
But the joke is that AIG was the one that had $1 trillion worth of worth.
Worth of what? Worth of?
Of worth. They had actual, real stuff. Their $1 trillion was a real $1 trillion.
Yeah, you said worth of with. What's with?
Worth of worth, I think I said.
Oh, worth of worth. They had actual, real worth, you're saying.
Yes. But the point is, their fine companies had profits, and they took those profits and put it in a division that was not regulated like a part of their company.
Yeah.
And when they got with their pants down, they didn't have enough liquidity to handle that, and so it wound up that their thing got taken over and is going to be sold off in pieces in order to cover this mischief that they'd gotten involved in.
Yeah.
And of course, the biggest joke is that the founder of that company, Hank Greenberg, was kicked out by them about 2.5-3 years ago and sued and all the rest of it, even though he settled some of those. He was kicked out, and it was after he was kicked out that they did all this. And he's the one who comes along and could have saved them and could have gotten with some sovereign funds and some rest of it, but they wouldn't talk to him. And so the government wound up taking it over anyway and splitting it all up. So finding out who the key people are on all that, that the mischief is where a lot of focus should go to see what else those key people may also be involved in and what associations they have, because there may be associations that goes from this company to that company, and you could go in and get all of them and stop a lot of it from the future, even though I think Congress is going to put some stipulations in there that's going to open it all up and the thing, but they got to put something in there that stops it from happening in the future,
yeah,
and takes care of the whole mess that started it in the first place. And you see, they don't go, they're trying to go on this side, and I'm saying that I don't think they're going to be able to do that unless they take care of this side in an equal amount. So the $700 billion may very well be $350 billion for what they want, $350 billion to attack the original problem and solve it, so that those two are balanced, and therefore the thing that they want to cure may not take as much on that side anyway. But it's like if they don't get it unless they do this other, then I think some remarkable turnarounds can occur. And the reason I think it's very interesting, because it would be almost as though it would be all set up and cleared before Obama ever takes office.
Yeah.
Because I'm sure that in terms of the election, as everybody sees all this and ties it so definitely into relation to the Republicans, I don't know how it could go. It would have to be very, very, very negative for it to even occur any other way.
Right.
And that, in that case, all of it's belly up all over the world. In other words, if they try to force McClain in through some kind of a weirdness and a nastiness, the whole thing's going to fall all over the world. So it's like, take Obama and love it, or everything collapsed. Because that's just what they've been saying to us about this $700 billion. Take it or leave it, or else it's all going to fall apart. Well, okay, we can play that. Take it or leave it, it's all going to fall apart. Everybody agrees that take it or leave it, everything's going to fall apart.
Okay.
And so then out of that can possibly become a reconciliation of yes and no. You know, the awareness symbol for the reconciliation of yes and no is the wishbone.
Mm.
And it's a it's also there is a use of that symbol with the blue pearl of mercy, that when we talked about it way back in 63 or 64, all of a sudden in jewelry stores were coming up these little silver wishbones with a blue pearl on them. And of course the blue pearl of mercy with the reconciliation of yes and no. Now if that's the way it goes, it would be marvelous for everything on all sides, because it would get done. And it's almost as though the fact that we all took this trip together and it landed, then that's the mercy, you see.
Yeah.
That's the mercy for everybody in that case, if there is a reconciliation, yes and no, and that occurs when they give equal amount to domestic as well as this thing, you know, right up the line to about equal, this actually solves the whole mortgage crisis all the way down through the thing. And, of course, obviously creates jobs, one of the things I thought. So many of these developments that got skunked and the people are gone, there's robbers going in and cleaning them out, ripping out the wiring and selling it for scrap metal and all the rest of it. Whole developments west of, I think it was Cleveland, of 1,200 homes was like that. 1,200 homes that were nice homes, and then overnight they were just trash.
Right.
All right. Now, the point is, one of the jobs, some of the jobs that could be created, is to create guards for all those houses to prevent that from happening. How many? That'll put a million people to work right there.
Yeah.
And then, in addition, what you have to do is have house sitters. Well, how about hiring house sitters that used to live there while you're arranging the mortgage to give them back what they want?
Yeah.
And is it, how does that? How does that?
That's very generous, Dave. Very generous. It's very generous.
Well, I just see it's a way toward it. That, I mean, it may or may not have any meaning, but if you look at the structure there and look what I've said, you can do it probably a week from now or a month from now, and what I say will hold true. No matter which way it goes, you know what could have happened, and if it didn't, why it happened.
Right.
Okay.
Okay, a couple points. Appearance of the jewelry in 63-64 is an example of the xenocrony. You guys have this concept,
yes.
And it shows up in the media.
In awareness, of course, a lot of other, there's 140 symbols. Others of parts of showed up in jewelry, too. But that, I thought, was so outstanding, so fast.
Right. Now, one interesting side note. Hank Greenberg is considered by one wing of those that think the somebody other than Bin Laden knocked down the towers on September 11th, Hank Greenberg, on some website to investigate this stuff, is a prime suspect of creating 911. So either it was done by AIG executives as a joke on Hank after they got rid of him. I don't know.
But that, they didn't get rid of him then. They didn't get rid of him till well after that.
That's what I mean. So, no, I'm saying that in 2005 or so, when the Hank Greenberg story surfaced, that he was the mastermind for 911, that would have been after he had been booted out, and it might have been a joke put out by his... the guys who executed him. So,
you mean they didn't execute him, but they threw him out.
They privatized him. They privatized him.
Yeah.
Now, the other thing is, I saw a headline today that America's middle class is enraged. They're not going to tolerate this nonsense of them having to pay all these new taxes. I was wondering, in your monitoring of the last few days, did you see anything like that?
Oh, yeah. That it's, I think 75% of the emails that are going into Congress are supposed to be something like that.
Okay.
And a huge amount of them are just saying no, 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 no.
Yeah. That's what they're
reporting. I mean, that's like somebody who saw some of the emails. That's the only thing that the email said is just send it to them and said no, 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 no.
That's right. That's what was quoted in this article.
Is that right?
Yeah, they were talking about most emails are just no, no, hell no.
Oh, I see. Okay, then I've got the same story. Some of the same information from a different direction.
Yes. Okay, so the
which is always great because it's just like all this stuff that you're doing with me and this book.
Yes.
I know. I've looked at it. I know that for 39 years you've heard me talk about all kinds of things, including stuff in this book.
Yeah.
I mean, stuff about the situations that this book also covers.
Yes.
And I'm sure that as things progress, you refer back to it, not necessarily checking to see whether I'm telling the truth or not, but to check if I said this or not.
Yeah.
And of course, you refresh my memory so that I go into a form of recall. And we light up that area and look at it, and I report it. And the other day you were talking to me, and I started saying it. And you said, oh, but that's already, it's in the next paragraph, you see, which was perfect.
Yeah.
So what it's done is it has gone inside my system and my path and lit up my path as though each part is present time. And so therefore the present time brightness is coming up through my system into this present time.
Yes.
All right. I got up out of a chair the other day, and my right foot, the toes popped, the ankles popped, the knees popped, the hip, and it went right up my spine and right up to the top of my head. You know, all in one swoop that took probably 3 or 4 seconds. Okay, that I could take as a surprise thing that happened independent of anything we're doing. But then I noticed after that there's some other ways in which I merely reach for a pencil or something like that that used to cause possibly spasms, and my body just responds and it pops again.
Wow.
So I'm having a higher level of attention, and you know what I think about is I heard that when Krishnamurti had his enlightenment in Ojai, he was walking across a field that was plowed. And as this enlightenment came on, that every joint in his body kept popping. I think there may even be a record of that someplace. And I thought, well, I've been relating on the interplane to Bob Carr to send light and healing, and he had some problem with his back. And so as that's releasing, I'm getting an echo over here that's making it better for me than it was before. This is what I feel.
Yeah.
But we'll have to find out. Well, for me, it's real. Whatever happens there, I'd like to feedback if there is any, you know.
Right. No, and Bob Carr still is in pain or, you know, resting.
I don't think so.
Oh, that's good, because he said he'd call me, you know, when he was better, and that was a few days ago, and he hasn't called, so who knows?
I don't think so, or if it is, it's not something that I'm tuning into at all, whereas I felt like I could tune in, and because of a correlation with what I'm going through, it wasn't very difficult to feel it. But then, since I'm not always trying to feel it myself, I had to go into something deeper than I usually do. And then at a certain point, it came out. And so that's why I say I don't think he's probably feeling it as much.
Because you're both releasing at the same time.
Probably. Yeah. It's speculation.
Yeah.
But you see, very often when I see it, I relate it. It's like a reportage.
Yeah.
And so I don't worry about whether I believe it or not, whether anybody else believes it or not. It's like just acting like a seer and stating what the seer sees. And if it matches up, it matches up. But if it doesn't, it's still good energy.
Right. Okay, so let's go back into the book. And I want to just revisit where we left off near the end of the last session over this issue, and I'm just going to say this, see if it sparks your memory. Do you recall Bob Carr coming down to San Francisco or Stanford in 68, 69 after he went up to do the Retina Circus in Seattle?
Yes,
had a hand in.
That's when let me see. I'm trying to remember the sequence of events, because the Retina Circus,
it goes up in the fall of 67 with your help.
Yeah, that was up to fall of 67.
Yeah, it goes up.
Okay,
to
in the summer of 67, there was a doctor they knew that lived in Marin County, and I went out to his place and swam in the pool and stuff. And so I can't remember. I remember the event that they knew this doctor. Well, the story is that doctor and a psychiatrist and Alan Watts and Bob and Connie set someone amongst them set up this clinic in Haight-Ashbury that was taking people who were having weird trips.
Yeah.
And running them through, and it's like they could bring somebody in and relate to them in a line, and then push them into a room and let them set. And in the meantime, their bad trip was gone. Anyway, that that was when Alan Watts started telling them, start dressing with color.
Yeah.
Because before that, they were just a bunch of beatnik drabs. And so that's supposed to be... I just wanted to interject that was in that time frame, I think, before they ever came up with the Retina Circus. And it was probably all set up so that as soon as they finished whatever they were doing with the Retina Circus, that they had a home to go through, you know, a group to relate to in order to acquire a place. And I think that's, I don't remember where they went.
Okay, listen to this. I just went to Wikipedia. Here's this. In response to this new population migrating to the Haight-Ashbury, you know, in 67, and a growing medical crisis caused by increased drug use and lack of health insurance, Dr. David E. Smith. Does that ring a bell?
Well, that's probably it. His name is Smith, so I'm trying to remember.
Yeah. He says, Dr. David E. Smith opened the Haight-Ashbury Free Clinic on June 7th, 1967.
See? Oh, this is good, isn't it?
Yeah. The first free clinic in the U.S. without a religious affiliation.
Hmm.
His goal was to provide free medical care for everyone under the motto, quote, health care is a right, not a privilege.
Hmm.
The clinic operated in the Haight-Ashbury district through 2007. Just went on for 40 years. Then moved most of its operations to the Mission District of San Francisco. And continues to provide medical care to those who would otherwise lack access to it. So you think that Bob Carr and Connie were involved with that clinic?
Absolutely, because I was out at this guy's place and they were relating and all the rest of it before that.
Yeah.
Let's see.
Now, remember, you're channeling in May around your birthday, 67, so this is like right at that time when you're going down to Olympia, I guess. Did you start in Olympia with Geraldine Morse?
Yeah, that was right after my birthday.
Yeah, so that's the. So do you recall doing that and going down to San Francisco around the same time, or maybe you went to San Francisco in earlier May before you got involved with the channeling?
No, I sort of remember that I went down or was gone. I know another time I was gone and they arrived at my house in Olympia. And my cat had just been killed, and so Bob and Connie and Chris buried the cat. When I came back, I found out about it, but I didn't. They had come and gone. But then in 1983, in Lake Elsinore, while I was gone, three of our dogs died of parvo, and Bob and Connie arrived and helped Chris bury them.
Wow. You mean they were coming to visit, and every time they visited, or twice, they had to bury
at least
on
two of the times. There's very few times that I, you know, that we didn't, when they came to visit me, most of the time when they did, I was gone, and at least two of the times, they had to bury dead animals.
And this is the first time is in 67. That you're saying the cat that
I think it was because I think it was on in the house south in the South Olympia that happened.
Okay, so now you're going through this timeline. So why do you begin with the free clinic? Then after that, in the fall, they go to Seattle, right, and start the Retina Circus, which they did a little bit in galleries and that in San Francisco between April and June or April and August.
Well, I don't think it was. I don't even know. I think. That when we arrived in down there,
down where,
at their house in Marin, we were going to have a dinner. And so they had all these people show up for this dinner.
Do you remember the name Lee Charlton and his wife Angie? That's who they went and stayed with in Marin County as soon as they came back from India. Lee Charlton.
They probably were there. I know there was another guy who had been a hockey player at one time, who now was a part of, so the three of them became Retina Circus as a, you know, if you call it a corporation or a partnership, then the three of them were involved. Anyway, after dinner, they kept doing all kinds of looks at each other and said, wait till you see what we've got after dinner. So then we go down in the basement, this large room, large long room, and they put on the first Retina Circus that I had ever seen. They had just started developing it, and they'd only been developing it for about 2 or 3 weeks, and in the midst of their developing it, they'd played in one nightclub, and somebody in the nightclub made connections with them, and then they played a performance in the gallery owned by the president of Reed College, but he had it in San Francisco, and that's where Wes Wilson and nine other psychedelic poster artists each had the originals for sale and copies for sale, and so I think they were selling them for about $5 or $10 a piece, but signed they were, you know, like $25 a piece, and people were taking them off. And anyway, Herb Cain wrote that when they had this opening, that the marijuana could be smelled for 2 blocks away because the crowd was right out front and they couldn't get in. Yeah, that'd be interesting. If
okay,
if
listen.
Bob reads that, he'll get a recall. He could probably tell you a lot more than I could.
You mean now reads it when if he hears what you just said?
Yeah.
Okay, he describes this. He says, I was not interested in getting back into the printing business, nor did Connie want to go back to the supermarket. No, all that was over. Helping Wes was one thing with the posters and that, but now we wanted to do something different with our interest in film and music. We decided to create a light show of our own, different from the ones that we'd seen at the Fillmore just, you know, a few weeks before. So the three of us, Connie, Bill, and that's Bill Duncan. You remember that name, Bill Duncan?
That's probably him.
Yeah. So the three of us, Connie, Bill, and I, rented a house in Marin County, like you said, and with some help from a friend, we began to build our own light show. We called ourselves the Retina Circus and started to get work with bands playing in small places to audiences that were eager to experience new forms of perception. The poster...
They only had about 3 or 4 events at all before they went to Seattle.
Yeah. Yeah.
As I recall. Of course, maybe there's some I didn't know about, but I think that's what I understood, that they had now wait a minute. When we were down there, that's how many had happened, but when we came back up and then arranged for them to come, so there was a time lag in there where they could have been performing quite a... I'm sorry. Okay.
No, that's... And he says something like that. He says, Wes Wilson, the poster artist, was becoming famous by now. A local San Francisco art gallery sponsored a joint show. Isn't that maybe what you're talking about?
Yes.
The with the
that,
lineup.
That was owned by the president of Reed College.
Yeah, and we did the lights. They did the lights at the art gallery.
Yep.
And you were there.
No.
Oh,
I just heard about it.
Okay.
Know.
He says the media was turned on to the event. The BBC filmed it, and all the leading San Francisco icons were there. We bathed the walls of the gallery with vibrant colors, shifting images, and pools of light. The music was by Country Joe and the Fish. I assume that the band was there, the real band. This was our, or they're playing records, but...
Not necessarily.
Okay.
It could be the records, because I don't know whether the gallery could have held a band, because it was a fairly narrow building and 3 stories, and so the size of the gallery wasn't all that big. But in other words, I'm not sure that they could have gotten a band in there.
Okay, so they're playing the music, but the point is that you are remembering this. You weren't there, you just remember the description.
Yeah, the whole... in other words, you have a total recall more than I do, but I have some.
Yeah.
And sometimes when somebody communicates something that I'm very interested to start with, as it registers, I have an idea that a part of me sort of goes into the astral plane and looks at it that way, almost like being there.
Yeah. Okay, so he says, the music was by Country Joe and the Fish. This was our first real chance to express our ideas, and we were called, quote, light painters by the press. So they had some press coverage. That must have been Herb Cain. They were called light painters by the press.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe Herb Cain. The phone rang one morning, and a music promoter from Seattle, Washington, wanted to know if we would like to come to Seattle and give light shows at a new concert hall. So this is where he forgets that.
Well, he just leaves out the whole thing of Winston, because Winston and I came down there.
Who?
And were there.
Winston
and
Turnbull.
Yeah. And Millette. And for one thing, I remember when we came in that right away after we'd been there for a while, because obviously we were going to have a chance to stay there, we were going to have dinner, that Winston goes over and tells Bob, can I see you in here? And Bob's kind of working in the kitchen, and he says, you're going to have to buy a bunch of food here. So he gave him a couple of 50s, and Bob looked at me, smiled, and he got his coat and took off, you know. And anyway,
Who gave who the money? Winston gave them some
Winston,
money?
Yeah. You know, it's like he flashed his money right away. And so Bob felt, well, here, I got an operator. And so then later when things developed, you know, he knew. And
he
as a matter of fact...
He knew what? Day, what are you saying? He knew what? He knew.
He knew that there was someone who had something behind him to do something. One thing we started to do...
This created the confidence to go up to Seattle.
Yeah, but one thing we started to do with them, we took a day or so to look for a fairly large building to set up a light show in. And we were even going to go down in the warehouse district
of Seattle.
We're talking about San Francisco.
While you're there.
And Winston's willing to front the lease.
Right.
You know, they were talking about $3,000 for a lease on something.
Right.
But it didn't quite come off, and so we didn't do it. Went back up, and then we brought them up. And then after we brought them up, we didn't make any money on it, but they put on their show, and this promoter that he's talking about came to visit, saw it, and hired them on the spot to come over there. So there's another case where something's put together, and when you put it together, it's so complete that they think that they did it themselves and leave out the whole process by which it occurred. Again and again and again, as I've told you.
Right. So it wasn't a phone call. It was when they were in Seattle that Boyd Grafmeyer showed up.
Right.
Yeah.
At the Norway Center where they were performing this thing, and we had we didn't have enough of an audience to pay for it, but we had enough to have the event, and then that got them the job. So in a sense, we felt good that they got the job. But both Winston and I felt, well, that was our good turn. Because we didn't make money.
Right. You were hoping to keep it going and you'd be part of it, but it didn't happen.
Well, the point is, I don't know what we expected.
Yeah.
We just went ahead and did it, and that because that was the outcome of it, then I always felt, well, it was a good outcome. Except for a couple other aspects of it, but those I just let go of.
Okay, so he says this person calls, wants to know if we would like to come to Seattle and give light shows at a new concert hall. Quote, my name is Boyd Grafmeyer, and I am calling for Concerts West. You remember that term, Concerts
mm-hmm.
West?
Yeah.
Connie replied, well, I don't know. I'll have to talk it over with my partners. Can I call you back? And jotted down his number. In San Francisco, there are only two real places to work in our business, the Fillmore and the Avalon Ballroom. All the other places were small and couldn't pay us enough money to live on. There were a number of light show groups in the area, so it was hard to survive from week to week. Connie was right in not saying yes to Boyd right away. He wanted to make sure that we could get the best contract. Moreover, we had to consider if we wanted to move away from the Bay Area.
they didn't know what was going to happen.
Right.
They really... So actually, they were braver than they're saying there.
Right. Finally, we decided, quote, yes, let's go. We can work every weekend there, and that's better than what we were doing here. Connie called him back the next day and worked out a price per show per weekend.
Oh, that was all done later.
Yeah, and told him that we would come on a trial basis. And Connie told Boyd that we would come on a trial basis and see how everything would work out. We packed our equipment into a new van we had bought and drove all day and part of the night to Seattle. Connie's parents put us up until the following weekend. In the morning, we met Boyd and checked out the hall. We were ready to turn on Seattle at the Eagles Auditorium. Remember that, the Eagles Auditorium?
I know, but the point...
The Norway place.
At their parents, but what they were doing was setting up at the Norway Center.
Not the Eagles Auditorium.
Yeah, and they didn't even know about the Eagles Auditorium. And then Boyd showed up and told them.
Yeah.
And as a matter of fact, the Eagles was operating, but it was not doing that much. And with the Retina Circus as the resident light show, and the bands you started bringing in, and because they got a big house, it turned out that the house that they had is where a lot of the bands stayed.
Yeah. It says here, the first concert was a success. We ironed out a contract to provide the lights for all of Boyd's shows. Then the Seattle Times interviewed us, and we told them that we were there to help turn on Seattle with our mind-bending lights and psychedelic circus. Connie, Bill, and I fit in quite easily with the new scene in Seattle. We were billed as coming directly from San Francisco, and we received recognition from the press. The police were also interested in the, quote, hippie types from Berkeley who are here to dehinge the minds of the youth. That was a quote from the police. Do you remember anything about that?
Well, about somebody else, but and it's like a similar quote.
Yeah. What was the other person about?
Well, it's when I had that that gallery that this was in 1960, I think, where this guy came up, this kid came up from San Francisco, and somehow he insinuated himself into my gallery while I was gone. And that guy, the guy who was supposed to be managing it, took off for the weekend, left him in charge, and the Seattle Times came in and interviewed him, and he talked like it was his my place was his place. And then he said, well, I'm a Baptist Buddhist from I'm a beatnik Baptist Buddhist come to shake up Seattle, and the name of my gallery was called The Subtle Game, and he says, I'm going to change it because I'm not going to be subtle. And so they put his picture on the top left, up, you know, on the front page, the left side, a great big picture of him, and three columns wide all the way down to the bottom on the front page. And I go to work, and these guys that I work with says, you know, you're on the front pages. Yeah. But they never mentioned my name. Remember I told you about hiding right out in the open so many times?
Yeah.
They, with all the chaos, talk about chaos that really occurred, that really was a tour de force. And anyway,
okay,
my name was never mentioned.
Right, but your friends knew it was your gallery.
Oh, well, I'm not going to... I mean, that's a whole side story, and we're not talking about that. We're talking about something else now.
Yeah, but you're saying your friends knew it was your gallery and thought that you were in the article, but then you weren't.
Yeah, because I was up here in Everett, and they knew I had the gallery, and they saw this, and so anyway, they told me about it, and so I went downstairs to try to find a paper, and there was a tavern right there, so I went in to ask if they had a paper, and I got one, and I was coming out of the tavern, and my boss pulled up right in front of me, like seeing me going into the tavern before coming to work. And he more or less said something to that effect, and then I showed him the paper. And so he gave me time off to come down and take care of it.
But, great. Okay, so the quote gets used again, you know, 7 years later, that some hippie types from Berkeley, Carr and his lover, Connie, were here to dehinge the minds of the youth, says the police. A newspaper writer who wrote an article on us told us later that there was a police report on us. What paranoia! The police were afraid that the youth culture was going to take over the nation. We were working all the time at the local rock and roll concert hall where Boyd was booking the top bands from England and the United States. We did our share of being involved in the anti-Vietnam War movement, taking part in parades, music concerts, and rallies, knowing, of course, that these actions were just exercises in making a public statement. We took part in a number of outdoor music festivals where huge crowds of young and older hipsters turned out for the New Rights, R-I-T-E-S. The outdoor music events would each last for 3 days and nights, would include dancing, naked, and, of course, sex of all kinds. Worcester was not there.
No, he doesn't say that.
Are you sure he doesn't say that? Okay, yeah, he doesn't say that. Well, maybe he does, but you were you there? Did you go to these outdoor festivals?
I think some of them. I don't know by what name they were, but...
Right. In this period, while you're channeling cosmic awareness, right? In 67 into early 68. Is that...
Yeah.
While you were channeling, you would get out and be part of the counterculture.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. The music went nonstop throughout the night, and when the sun began to rise, we would turn off our lights. The festivals were an orgy of the senses, and one's brain and body were pushed to their limits. Only the young could take it. It was hippieville, and with overstimulated minds, all sorts of wild ideas were projected as reality. Everyone was given license to do his or her thing in quotes. Universal love opened doors to all, and it was a mix of every imagined concept that mankind dreams about. There was order in disorder. Chaos was accepted, and somehow everyone seemed to love one another in these mass events of coming together to celebrate freedom and love. Well, the chaos has become a huge media spectacle by now.
You're doing a commentary now.
Yeah, I'm saying
I can tell the voice change.
And the chaos, in that sense, the counterculture prefigured the coming chaos in the global theater.
Does he say anything about the quadraphonic, the first quadraphonic show?
I think maybe later he does, but that's further along.
And the performances at the Opera House, first with the symphony and Joffrey Ballet.
Oh, yeah, he does a lot on that.
That was so sensational that they hire them to do 10 daytime programs and bust in kids from schools all over the city for 10 performances.
He mentions that.
Yeah, okay.
So this is his, he's just commenting on, he's come from being with Krishnamurti, and within a year he is saying this: I was seduced by this openness and desire to unshackle the safety restraints of middle-class society with its uncompromising beliefs and outdated religious morals, ethics, and dead ideas sold to us as a way of life. Was there hope in this vision of a new world, or was it just another dream, an escape from our tormented world? In other words, where's the gaff, right? Where's the gaff?
He always...
Yeah.
Oh, well.
Always looking for the gaff. Could the young change the world, or would they fall victim to the same currents of culture they shared with their parents? I'm as aware now as then that it takes more than just replacing one idea with another to effect change. We may be just a little different from our parents, but we share the same seeds of thought. We may react to the indifference and dead ideas that stifle our lives, but it takes more than new ideas to bring about any change in our nature. Then he says, but what was happening... But what was happening to my spiritual pursuits and the Dharma? And what about my old friends in Seattle who used to attend the center? So Phyllis, he quotes Phyllis, what happened to Robert? The Robert I used to know, said Phyllis when we met for lunch one day. She wanted to know what effect Krishnamurti had on me and why I'd taken on this new appearance, you know, looking like a hippie. I told her, quote, we all go through changes. Why stay the same? We are just an image, something that we imagine about ourselves. We can't stay stuck in the same thing. We have to go on living. That's life. Inside, I'm still the same. That part never changes. Just my appearance is different. Phyllis wants the old, he says to Phyllis, Phyllis wants the old Robert, not this prankster. Behind the,
he's calling himself a prankster.
Right. There's the gaff, right? Behind the mask.
Well, no, I mean, he's referred to Krishnamurti as that, and one time I think Connie referred to me as one. I think what he did with me is he called me the trip master one.
Trip master, yeah. But what he's doing is that when he gets into this public scene that's happening, he considers totally an act by himself, and he's a prankster. He's putting it all on. Because any of the dreams the young kids or people in their 20s or 30s who had at that time, he had gone through that 10 years before.
Uh-huh.
You know, in terms
why,
of...
Why, could, why he could dance.
Yeah, why he could dance. Yeah.
So to speak, you know.
Yeah.
You know how that is.
Yeah. So he said,
by the way, I heard that the, Vicky saw your dance.
Oh yeah, she was she sent me an email. She liked it.
Yeah, she asked you to adopt her.
That was after she saw the pictures of Hawaii.
Oh yeah, that's right.
Yeah, but yeah, she loved the. I could look it up. Have right here. She loved the dancing. Yeah. Okay, so Phyllis wants the old Robert. He says to her, "Not this prankster. Behind the mask I wore, I was the same person she had known in the past." Unquote. That's the end of that. Then he says, "Yes, of course." I guess he continues. You know, continues the quote. He says, "Yes, of course. I'm still very interested in what Krishnamurti talks about. That can never not be. Once you have been bitten by poison, it never leaves." Then he goes into this thing. The University of Washington student body president Tom Gunn asked me if I would give some talks to students. Now this would be 68. The Paul Seibel stuff is in 71. 3 years later, I saw Robert speak somewhere around the University of Washington in 69.
You did?
Yeah, late 69, early 70, we attended a Bob Carr talk. And maybe he's talking about those talks.
Now, you and I, are you and Carolyn?
No, Carolyn and I, you, Paul Seibel, Jim Hewitt.
We collectively attended that talk.
Yeah, and it was in some institution like a basement place. On the university campus, maybe, you know, something like that.
But okay.
That may explain this, because he's saying the University of Washington student body asked him. Now, this could have been, you know, 2 years later, but Bob's blurring it together. Because he is talking about a period of time, a couple of years, when he's doing the concerts and the general role-playing he was doing. And so he said, Tom Gunn asked me if I would give some talks to students. I had met Tom sometime back at someone's house, and we had talked about how everybody was interested in trying to change society or break away and form a different world. Everyone talked about change, yet I told them that the world could only change if the individual could change. Creating new institutions had been tried before, and the result was that nothing really changed. We just would exchange different leaders who, given the chance, would steal and rob from us in their turn. We talked for some time, and he concluded that what I was saying was different. It made an impression on him. Well, was that why he asked me if I would consider his offer? I told him that I would give it some thought and call him back. Three talks were arranged outdoors on the campus grounds near the library. Now, we didn't go to outdoor talks. It, very much to my surprise, the talks were well attended. I spoke about why people were looking for answers to the mess the world is in, while not really understanding that the problems were inside the person. How could we free ourselves from the way we were brought up by the society, from our religious thinking and the brainwashing we call education? I told the students that the whole structure of thought is at war with itself. These talks did give me a chance to express my thoughts, to clarify what I thought I understood about our problems and our hopes that somehow everything would change someday, way off in the future. It's difficult to be honest and to see into oneself. Who was I to give talks? He's always contradicting or doubting himself or questioning.
Oh, well, that's he's doing role-playing, too.
Yeah. Who was I to give talks? For 7 years, I had remained silent. So that's 60 to 67, 68, right? Now I wanted, so this is like 68, now I wanted to see why I wanted to talk, why I wanted to be the one who knows. One can fool oneself. It's very easy to fool others and in turn fool yourself. It was very nice sitting under the trees outside, but I felt the space between students sitting there, and myself. Did they understand the situation? There is no real communication between people. You can batter at the foundations of their thinking. That's all you can do. Later on, I was invited to give some talks at a conference on the new awareness, capitalized, new awareness.
All right, later on is like a long time. So he says later on, that's a long time span.
Has to be 3 years.
Well, perhaps.
Yeah, but as far as you remember, he did not speak in Stanford while he was in Seattle in 68, 69, because you weren't even down at Stanford at that time.
No, I have a brochure. Let me look for a moment. Maybe I can pull it right out and read it.
Break here. David's looking for the brochure. And this is page, if you want to read the book, we're reading from God Men, Con Men by Robert Carr. Came out in 2003, published in India, in New Delhi, And we're on page 138, and this is where he's going to mention Dave Worster again.
If you'd asked me to look for this, I might have taken a day or two to try to find it.